If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Democracy is under attack. Western governments are trying to regulate the internet to shut down free speech. Australia and the UK are taking control of their domestic internet. What's next for the US? Lighting the fuse for freedom. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back. It's Tuesday, the 17th of January. If you've just joined me, I've just had June Slater on the show for a very enjoyable rant about the state of the UK and the world. Okay, next up, we have a UK cardiologist on the show, but not just any cardiologist. We have the eminent Dr. Aseem Malhotra. Aseem is an NHS-trained consultant cardiologist and a world-renowned expert in the prevention, diagnosis, and management of heart disease. Aseem has been on a journey over the past 2 years. He believes the mRNA vaccines contributed to his father's death from a heart attack last year. And since then, he's been on a mission to put the growing body of evidence showing that the vaccines are unsafe in front of the public. There are many things that I want to talk about with Aseem. One of them is his BBC interview, which has had more than 20 million views on Twitter alone. We'll also be talking about Andrew Bridgen and how he's been treated awfully by his colleagues and the press. We'll be talking about censorship of doctors and the fear used to keep them quiet. And also, I want to hear from Aseem where he thinks we are in terms of getting this message that the vaccines are dangerous out to the public. Now, something is definitely afoot in the UK and pretty much in every Western country in the world. Excess deaths in the UK have been running at around 1,000 a week since May 2020. And if you look into the, if you delve down into the deaths, they're across all age groups, these excess deaths, including people in their 20s and 30s. And then when you look further into the data, you can see that the major cause of these excess deaths is heart problems. Now, this isn't normal for young people to be dying suddenly of heart problems, right? And this has been going on long enough now that the government and media feel compelled to talk about it. But all they want to do is point the finger at everything and anything but these new experimental vaccines. Before Christmas, the British Heart Foundation claimed it was all down to delays in ambulance response times. Now, this is ridiculous because while that might explain some more deaths of people who suffered heart attacks, it doesn't explain why more young people are having heart attacks in the first place. Then 2 weeks ago, we had the UK's chief medical officer, Sir Chris Whitty, saying that it was down to missed GP regular health checkups and a drop in the use of statins. Well, I mean, the first thing I'll say about that is, since when did young people have regular GP health checkups these days? It's hard enough to get a GP appointment, never mind regular health checkups. But then the following week, after Chris Whitty made that statement about statins, Carl Hennigan, the director of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, published some analysis that totally debunked what Chris Whitty had said. Carl looked at the number of people you need to give statins to reduce one death and the length of time you need to give it to them. And he proved that statins are not responsible. Now, the alarming thing here is that it shows that the chief medical officer in the UK, Sir Chris Whitty, had no evidence for his claims. He is the chief medical officer, and he has been briefing government based upon speculation. Now, in my opinion, I think this is a resigning matter. How can he possibly keep his job after this? But let me know what you think. You can message me via the chat on the website. Right. In a minute, I'm going to be joined by Dee Dee Denslow to talk about the big stories in the news. But hang around, because after that, we'll be joined by Dr. Aseem Malhotra. But do you have a suggestion for any guests that you'd like to hear us host, or any topics that you'd like us to talk about? If so, then please do get in touch via the form on the TNT website and help make us make a difference on TNT Radio.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Right, Darren, what's this headline about? Ukraine's defeat may lead to World War III.
We've heard it bandied around so many times, James, since the invasion back in February, Russia's invasion of Ukraine back in February. World War III, nuclear Armageddon, and again, the Prime Minister of Poland has urged Germany, this is how they're going to solve the potential threat of a World War III, send more weapons to Ukraine. I'm not sure how that works, but it seems like that's their answer. Yeah, Ukraine's defeat may lead to the Third World War, so Germany and other NATO countries must step up and send Kiev more weapons, Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki claimed on Monday, speaking in Berlin at a celebration of German politician Wolfgang Schäuble's 50-year career. Morawiecki insisted that Germany must allow the delivery of Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Poland and Finland have promised Kiev the tanks, but need formal German permission to actually hand them over. Today, Ukrainians are fighting not only for freedom, but also in defense of Europe, Morawiecki insisted. I call on the German government to act decisively and deliver all types of weapons to Ukraine. The defeat of Ukraine may become a prelude to World War III, so today there is no reason to block support for Kiev and postpone matters indefinitely, he added. The Polish PM also spoke of Ukrainian blood being shed. Yes, we are using Ukrainians, now even their civilians, as cannon fodder for the Russian machine to prevent what he claimed could be a Russian attack on other EU countries. Last week, Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Rezanov said in an interview that Ukraine was shedding blood to carry out NATO's mission. A rather change in narrative from Ukraine. It's the first time they've actually insinuated that, and this was on their mainstream press. Germany also has about 110 Leopards it could potentially hand over to Ukraine, 88 of which are the old Leopard 1s, but actually making them fit for service would cost hundreds of millions of euros and take about a year to get them prepared. Moscow has repeatedly warned the West that sending weapons to Kiev is merely prolonging the conflict and would not change the outcome. German tanks will burn like the rest of Western weapons, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Monday. Morawiecki's visit came on the same day German Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht confirmed she was stepping down. Germany was also supposed to begin the deployment of Bundeswehr-operated Patriot air defense batteries to Poland. So the answer to preventing World War III is to send more weapons, more powerful weapons, more expensive weapons, and lots of them to Ukraine so that the Russians can just blow them up on arrival, James.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'll comment on this is the censorship on this, because this is a theme, obviously, we're talking about today. You know, if you ask any questions or you question the logic about the vaccines, then you're an anti-vaxxer. But if you question anything to do with the strategy or what led up to this war, then you're a Putin supporter. And it's exactly the same thing. It's designed to shut down the argument because, look, you know, I don't support Russia and I also don't support the US and NATO in what it's doing. But I do think this is something that's really, really worrying. This whole thing, they're cornering Russia. In putting them in a corner, and I do think it's really, really dangerous. And I do worry about all of these people across the UK who have bought in to, you know, this narrative that's been fed to us by the US and our mainstream media. And, you know, they've got Ukraine flags on their Twitter handles and stuff. And look, you know, the one set of people that I feel really, really sorry for in all this is actually the Ukrainian people, because what's going on here is they're caught in between a proxy war in between the US and Russia and NATO supporting the US. So I feel really, really sorry for those people. But, you know, we should be encouraging a peaceful settlement. You know, there's lots of reasons why this war happened. I don't condone the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine. But, you know, imagine if this for just a second, that Russia made friends with Mexico or Canada and started putting biological labs on the border with the US, labs that are, by the way, owned by defense companies, because that's what's going on in Ukraine. US defense companies owning bio labs, doing gain of function research. I mean, this has all come out. It's all been acknowledged by the Senate, the US Senate. Imagine if Russia did that. What would the US do? What would they do? They would send the tanks in, wouldn't they, Darren?
No, of course they would. Of course they would. Those missiles pointing at the US or bio labs, they would be wiped off the face of the earth in an instant, and the American public would demand it. And at the same time, we're calling on Russia as this terrible bad guy, Putin bad, and yet he's got weapons pointed at him, at his country, at his countrymen. They've got biological bio labs, bio weapons labs, and even worse, all of this is being run by a Ukrainian government that's been captured by actual Nazis. And the British public, the American public, the public around the world are expected to empty their tax pounds and dollars and euros and whatever currency it is and pour it into Ukraine to support these people and their objectives. I can't understand how an anti-war message is seen as a bad thing, you know, and you know what it's like on social media. You're anti-war, you get demonized. But if someone asked me to pin me down on who I want to pick a winner. There's a war going on. Which winner? Who do you want to win? Who do you agree with? I hate to say it because I'm a British person, I'm an Englishman, I'm a patriot, but we're in the wrong in this conflict. You cannot blame Putin for standing up and trying to protect his country from a threat, James.
Well, I mean, I would add a little bit more to that. I don't think Putin is the good guy, but also I don't think that we're the good guys either. And this is like I think they see this as a geopolitical game of chess. But the thing is, there are real people being impacted by this, and it should be a concern for the whole world because both sides are nuclear armed. If we push Russia too far, goodness knows what's going to happen. So, you know, right from the start, I've always called for peace. We need negotiations. We need to sit down across the table and work out what will make Russia feel safe and secure so that it doesn't need a buffer between it. You know, what do we need to do that? That's what we need to be doing. And unfortunately, the same as in the vaccine debate, when you do that, you actually call for peace, you get called a Putin supporter. It's the same tactics as calling people anti-vaxxers for asking questions about the vaccine. So, you know, I think there's lots of things in the world to be worried about today. The economic situation, you know, this planned pandemic, and also these experimental vaccines that are being pushed on each other. But, you know, all of that pales in comparison to what would happen if there was a nuclear conflict. So my message is peace. We need to sit down and negotiate. Okay, thank you very much, Darren.
No worries, James. Sorry, enjoy your conversation. Enjoy your conversation with Dr. Asim Malhotra. I'll be listening very intently to what he has to say. So good luck, and I hope all the listeners stay tuned in. Very important guest. Thank you.
Yeah, a very, very important guest. Dr. Asim Malhotra has done much over the past year to help raise the alarm about these mRNA vaccines. He is a experienced hand at this kind of thing. He's been fighting about the overuse of statins for many years. He's a general good guy, and I love him to bits, and I'm honored that he would join me on the show in a moment. So stick with me. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Politically incorrect on TNT Radio.
I welcome you, Senator Hanson, and I'm going to just ask you for your thoughts on Australia giving up its sovereignty to bodies like the United Nations and WHO without hardly a whimper from anyone in the political class.
I was one of these naive Australians that didn't know what was actually going on in our country. Couldn't understand why we seem to be controlled by outside interests, and it has become more noticeable to me as the years have gone on. Now, when we actually have signed up to the human rights or the refugee program or WHO and the United Nations, all these bodies, we are basically being controlled or told by them, because it's a body of people on it from different countries around the world. People have no association with Australia, have never been here, and yet they're, you know, dictating to us. Where we've lost our sovereignty, we elect our governments, we should be in control of our country. But we're not, because under Section 51 in the Australian Constitution, it's called external affairs. So when we sign treaties with other countries, we're bound by those treaties. And it really gets quite involved.
Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective, to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election for people of faith is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
Email leaks reveal Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs was in regular communication with Twitter, telling them who to censor. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio. And I have a very special guest with me next, Dr. Aseem Malhotra. What a fantastic guy. I've been working in the background with Aseem for about a year now. I've published several interviews on, you can find on Rumble or on Twitter. And Aseem's been on a journey, you know, because if you go back 2 years ago, you know, like a lot of other doctors, or like most doctors really, he thought the vaccines were going to help, be helpful. And like all the other doctors, you know, he was supportive of them. But one of the things that's made Aseem very, very different from all the other doctors is he has changed as the evidence has changed. And around, I think, early last year, Aseem started to see evidence that maybe the vaccines weren't what they were made out to be. His father sadly passed away from a heart attack last year, and Aseem believes that the mRNA vaccines were a huge contributory factor. So I am honored that Aseem is joining me today. He's a role model for other doctors. We need other doctors to do the same and start speaking out based upon the evidence that has changed. Hello, Aseem.
Hi, James.
Hi, Asim. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I'd really like to start with this BBC interview. It's absolutely amazing. More than 20 million views on Twitter alone. How the hell did you get the BBC to agree to that interview?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, first of all, James, I've done a lot of work. I mean, I've been a campaigner and activist for over a decade now in the mainstream media, you know, initially writing articles in The Observer, The Guardian, every single newspaper, I think, probably I've written for several articles over the years on different issues, starting around obesity, sugar, too much medicine, etc. I've also appeared on the BBC. You know, I've lost count of the amount of times I've appeared on BBC News over the years. So they've got me in their books. Even during the pandemic, I was the first person to publicly highlight the link between worse COVID outcomes and obesity. And again, I was on BBC News Channel then. I was on Good Morning Britain. And that was based upon research that I'd done and articles I'd written on that particular area. So the BBC, you know, I've been on their books. There's nothing new there. The only thing that was, and the other thing to add in as well, James, is that when the, you know, when my father died and there was an ambulance delay that happened, I, you know, investigated that in July 2021. And from a very reliable source, and I wrote about it in the I newspaper, they confirmed all that with their investigation. A reliable source told me that the Department of Health and NHS England had essentially been covering up the fact that the ambulances throughout most regions in the UK at that time were not meeting their targets for emergencies. And I exposed that in the eye, and then it became a BBC News story. And in fact, that's what triggered all of the discussion on the ambulance delays. So, you know, this is something that I've been doing for a very long time as an activist. And for me, it's about, you know, making sure that the government and medical establishment and are accountable to the public and patients. So, you know, so that's the background anyway. And in fact, on that as well, I did a BBC Newsnight report in 2012. I don't get paid for any of this stuff, by the way, just in case people are asking, where I spent several days with a producer, and I was, it was a headline in BBC Newsnight where I was the angry cardiologist asking why during the Olympic Games that we had in 2012, why were our main sponsors McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Heineken, and Cadbury's when we've got an obesity epidemic? So, you know, I'm known to them and I've done work. And then I even guest edited a BBC Radio 5 Live program with Nihal Arthanaika just for the pandemic, which was entitled "Is Your Doctor Dishing Out Too Many Drugs?" Again, around my work on highlighting the harms of too much medicine, which is all relevant. And then last week, well, in fact, it was Friday, the main news story, which was picked up by the BBC and other outlets, including, I think it was front page of the Daily Express where I was quoted, was around the fact that NICE had decided to suggest that we should be giving more people statins, even what 25 million people in this country should be taking statin drugs. I'm also an expert on statins. I've published papers in medical journals. I've done analyses. I wrote my last book called Statin Free Life, which was a bestseller, was published in the summer of 2021. So this is an area of expertise for me. All, again, comes back to heart disease. So they called me around, you know, only about half an hour before I did the interview, saying that we're doing a discussion on statins and what is your response to this? And I chatted to the producer and I explained, of course, everything about statins and it should be about informed consent. Yeah. And actually, my overall view generally is that we should be focusing on lifestyle for the people at low risk, not pushing statins as a first option. And that was the real discussion initially around it. But then when I went on and then said, can you know, she'll check with her editor. And then they said, fine, we'd love to have you on. So I rushed back from the gym. I was in the gym at this point near where I live. So I rushed back from the gym just because she said, you know, can you come on earlier than initially planned? Because it was literally, you know, within 30 minutes of the phone call, they said, we want you on at 10 past nine. I said, fine. So I went on there. And then, you know, spontaneously, of course, because it was a long interview and it was 7 minutes in the end, and the relevance of the statin discussion was brought up more recently because Chris Whitty had suggested that one of the reasons behind, or a major reason behind, the excess cardiac deaths that we're seeing is because people aren't taking their statin pills or blood pressure pills. So I weave that into the discussion because it was relevant, of course. Like, why are we suddenly talking about statins now? It was absolutely relevant. And then the thread was then brought us into this cardiac death issue. Of course, I mentioned, you know, my peer-reviewed research and really very overwhelming high-quality evidence that suggests that a likely, not the only, but a likely contributory factor that we can say with good evidence to the excess deaths is the COVID mRNA vaccine. And then, you know, I tweeted it out and it's obviously gone viral. And then with the expected, anticipated backlash that would ensue afterwards, which I was waiting for.
Yeah, well, thank you for your tenacity, Asim, because, you know, it's been a real battle, hasn't it, over the last year or so to try and get this message. You know, what we're not saying, and I think you're the same, is we're not saying that we're not trying to put a figure on it or saying all the excess deaths are due to the COVID vaccines. What we're saying is we need a proper independent investigation into this. And until that happens, there's enough evidence to suggest that these need to be withdrawn. Now, so Chris Whitty has been going on about statins, and I've seen lots of newspaper articles about how they should be just dished out like sweets to 25, potentially another 25 million people in the UK. What do you think about that, Asim?
Well, you know, let's just examine it in a rational way. You know, I'm a very big, strong advocate for evidence-based medicine, ethical evidence-based medical practice. And at the heart of ethical evidence-based medical practice, James, is informed consent and something called shared decision-making. Now, I'm not just a lone voice in this. In 2015, I coordinated a campaign between the British Medical Journal and the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges. I was lead author in this report, which also included the chair of the Medical Royal Colleges, arguably the most important doctor in the country at that point, and the chair of the General Medical Council. And in that, we talk about the fact that medical training, you know, postgraduate, undergraduate training needs to be updated and changed so that doctors, when they have conversations with patients, it should be having discussions where we are discussing benefits and harms of medications in absolute risk terms. So in terms of statins, to answer your question more specifically, and this is something that, again, I've published peer-reviewed research in and analyzed, and it's irrefutable, is if you look at the drug industry-sponsored trials, which is essentially most of where our information from statins comes from, and the reason that's relevant is, you know, that their raw data on these randomized controlled trials has never been independently shared. So this is likely best-case scenario. If you have a low risk of having a heart attack in the next heart attack or stroke in the next 10 years, i.e. a risk of less than 20% to start with, then your benefit from taking a statin based upon drug industry sponsored research, which is likely best case scenario in people who do not get side effects, is around 1%. So you have to take a statin drug religiously every day for 5 years to get a 1% benefit in it preventing a non-fatal heart attack or stroke, but it will not prolong your life. Now, that is the conversations I have with my patients all the time on statins and people at low risk. And I encourage them to make a decision based upon that information. That's even without talking about side effects. And actually, other research shows, James, that in most people, when given that information that way, would prefer not to take a statin. So it's very bizarre and strange.
Well, that sounds, yeah.
The other thing to add in, you know, we're talking about individuals here, but then we're also talking about, is it an important, you know, does it have an important impact on the population? And unfortunately, increase in statin prescriptions, even prior to these recommendations, have not shown any significant reduction in cardiovascular mortality in European countries. And the reason for that, James, is based upon the same data, you can look at the statistics slightly differently. And you can calculate what would be the average increase in life expectancy or median increase in life expectancy over a five-year period from people both at high risk and low risk taking statins. Now, if you're high risk, where there is a stronger benefit for individuals, the overall average increase from randomized control trial data in people who likely did not suffer side effects, because often these trials are designed, or, you know, you could even use the word rigged, to give you the best case scenario, because people with side effects are either taken out before the trial begins, or they design the trials after time, understanding who are the likely people to get side effects, and they don't include them in the trial. So these are people who are tolerating the statins, taking them religiously. And people are quite shocked when I tell this at doctors' conferences as well. They're gasped from the audience when I ask them, how much longer do you think you'll live if you've had a heart attack and you take a statin? And based upon that data, the median, and this is published in BMJ, median increase in life expectancy over a five-year period in people at high risk from taking a statin is just over 4 days, James. So you've got that.
Can I stop you there just a second?
Yeah.
I'll just stop you a second. We're just going to go for a quick news headlines and then we'll be straight back and we'll pick up exactly where we left off. Thank you, Asim. We'll be back in a second.
Now, TNT Radio News.
I have huge news.
Are you ready for it?
Yeah. Do it.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. At least 40 civilians have been killed and dozens more remain unaccounted for after a missile struck a residential building in the Ukrainian city of Dnipro after being shot down by Kyiv's own air defence systems. 10 people have reportedly been killed and dozens more wounded after a bomb was detonated inside a church in Central Africa. And an American man fighting for Ukraine has spoken out against the country, exposing a raft of failures by Kyiv's forces.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back. Well, listen, I'm honored today to have the eminent Dr. Asim Malhotra on the line with me. Hello, Asim.
Hi, James.
So before the break, we were talking about statins. So if you want to carry on where you left off, I think we were talking about the absolute risk.
Sure.
And yeah.
Yeah. So the average increase, if you look at it as a group of people, is about 4 days over a five-year period. And then the reason why there hasn't been any reduction in cardiovascular mortality in European countries, you know, since sort of 2000, is because a lot of patients stop taking their statin. So up to about 50% within a few years. Even some figures say higher than that will stop taking it because of side effects. They're not serious life-threatening side effects, but they're side effects that interfere with the quality of life, such as muscle fatigue, all sorts of other things that can happen, brain fog, et cetera, stomach problems, which are actually quite common. And for me, you know, I always ask the patient if they've got a symptom, you know, which we think is a side effect, is it interfering with the quality of their life? And if they say, yes, doc, it is, then of course that's a reason to have another discussion about the statin benefits, maybe reduce a dose or stop it altogether. So that's really where we are at. And therefore, it was very bizarre and strange that NICE would come out with the guidance to even and to suggest that we should even lower the threshold for prescription. And, you know, that's really what I discussed, you know, on BBC News Channel on Friday. For me, that isn't the best approach. And of course, James, the real issue on multiple fronts, even for COVID, is the fact that we have not made any good progress at all. In fact, we're getting worse in terms of tackling the lifestyle diseases that plague this country, specifically the obesity epidemic. You know, our life expectancy stalled since 2010. More and more people are living longer with chronic disease. In other words, we are regressing in general as a society. We are regressing in terms of our health. And it's not because people aren't taking enough statins, mate. It's because we haven't really effectively addressed lifestyle for individuals and the population.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I've got a real beef with a local issue here where you know, one of my kids goes to school, a local school, and they've got a McDonald's literally 100 meters from the school. And when you drive around Wales and the UK, you know, it seems like every other roundabout there's a fast food drive through. So I totally agree with you there. I think the government really need to get their act in order and start trying to support actively, not just talking about it, but helping people to change lifestyles. Right. Okay. Let's move on. So Andrew Bridgen has been one of the brave, very, very few politicians which is speaking out. Christopher Chope has also been speaking out over the past year. But Andrew Bridgen recently, he gave a speech in Parliament, fantastic speech, evidence-based speech, where he laid out all the evidence on the mRNA vaccines. And he has been attacked for it. What do you think of the way he's been treated, Asim?
Oh, I think it's absolutely appalling. It's horrendous. I attended the event. In fact, when Andrew gave that speech, which I thought was, you know, I think everything he said in that speech was spot on, in keeping with the up to date evidence. And you know, I think what's happened as a result, you know, it was unfortunate that, you know, the tweet that he put out that he then deleted, which was referencing the Holocaust. But the reaction is completely disproportionate. And, you know, it's appalling. It's appalling. Absolutely appalling.
Yeah, I mean, we even saw, I think it was a Guardian, I think I'm right in saying it was a Guardian article where they used the word anti-vaxxers grooming of the MP. I mean, so kind of, you know,
grooming gangs of anti-vaxxers, James. Grooming gangs.
What do you think? Yeah, I mean, that's a good question itself. What do you think of the term anti-vaxxer?
Oh, I think it's I think it should be treated in a derogatory way now, that term. It should be considered in the same way that we consider racist terminology, James, because, you know, it's not helpful. It's it doesn't encourage, you know, it polarizes people. It's been used, it's been weaponized by vested interests, in my view, to attack those who are actually questioning the narrative that's ultimately coming from people who care more about making money than they do about population health and public health and the truth. So I think it's deliberately been weaponized. And actually, from a doctor's perspective, you know, in this country, we've never mandated vaccines like this thing that happened where, you know, as you remember well, Sajid Javid originally suggested we need to mandate the vaccine for NHS staff, healthcare workers, and I campaigned very heavily, in fact, on mainstream news, including the BBC, BBC Breakfast, Sky News, to say we should overturn this, and we did successfully. But, you know, it's been, when we talk about vaccines, certainly in this country, we don't mandate vaccines like they do in the US. Interestingly, and we're talking about traditional vaccines here, which I'm a very big proponent and supporter of, mainly because it's one of modern medicine's greatest achievements, and certainly compared to other drugs, you know, very effective and very safe. You know, we've never mandated it because we rely on persuasion rather than coercion. And that's actually something good in British medicine. The British Medical Association, the medical colleges, didn't even support that we should mandate the vaccine for NHS, you know, healthcare workers, because that's not something that we do in this country. So I would prefer, I think it would be better to use, you know, people don't want to have vaccines. That's their decision. But actually, a more reasonable, a fairer term would to call someone vaccine hesitant or vaccine skeptic. Anti-vaxxer, I think, has just been totally abused. And, you know, I was very disappointed that Matt Hancock in Parliament was then equating, you first of all, using the word anti-vaxxer, when many of the people who've been strong proponents questioning the current continued rollout of the COVID vaccine had the vaccine themselves. So that's a false statement. But then conflating it with anti-Semitism, it's appalling. It's nonsense. It's beyond nonsense. It's disgusting. It needs to be called out for what it is. I think what's really interesting after this sort of hatchet job attack piece on myself and Andrew Bidgen in the Times is that the majority of their readership are actually supporting us. If you look at the comments, if you judge it from the comments, so they've overreached, and it's a sign of desperation. The attacks were not unexpected. In fact, to be honest, in some ways, I see that a sign of success. James, because I literally could have predicted all these moments going forward, because I've been an activist. I understand people who've been activists in the past as a public health advocate. You know that as soon as your work threatens an industry or an ideological cabal, you will be attacked, sometimes unrelentingly and viciously. And that's exactly what happened. But, you know, one of my inspirations is Mahatma Gandhi. And one of his quotes is this: first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So this is just part of the fight. So this is progress.
Fantastic. And that's exactly how I see it as well. I think the term that I've always been told from being in political circles is it's a little bit like being in a bomber in World War II. You know, you don't start to get flak, or you start to get flak when you get near the target, and you know you're being successful when you start to get that flak. Right. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. So stick with me, Aseem, and we'll be back straight after this short break.
With his expert analysis and opinion,
this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
My, how the pieces have fallen into place. I'm talking, of course, about the Biden document scandal. We knew from Tony Bobulinski 2 years ago that 10% of Hunter's ill-gotten gains from Burisma in Ukraine and his various Seneca Rosemont companies in China went to the big guy, but we didn't know how that transaction was accomplished. Well, now it turns out that drug-addled Hunter was paying $50,000 per month rent to, guess who? Joe Biden, to lease the Wilmington house that had the locked garage that had the Obama-era documents relating to what countries? Iran, Ukraine, and China. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along now. Did Hunter have a key to that locked garage? We're guessing that he did. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
How about some good news? There is a cure for hepatitis C. A simple blood test will tell you whether or not you have hepatitis C. More than 9 out of 10 people who receive highly effective treatment are cured and less likely to develop liver cancer or liver complications. One little blood test and you'll have done your part to help eliminate hepatitis C for good. Get tested. Get treated. Get cured. Visit hep.org for more information.
The Congo provides 60% of the world's cobalt. Children as young as 7 breathe in cobalt-laden dust so you can drive an electric vehicle.
We mandate that the truth be told.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining me, James Freeman, on The Freeman Report on TNT Radio. Today I'm joined by the eminent Dr. Aseem Malhotra. So Aseem, I don't want to spend too much time on talking about this vaccine specifically because, you know, you've been very, very vocal on that. And anybody who wants to hear your message on that can go on YouTube, can go on Twitter and listen to you there. But what I would like you to do is just give me no more than around 2 minutes, just a quick summary of your message on the mRNA vaccines to the public, please.
Well, I think the key message is this, James, that certainly now the benefits from the vaccine are very, very low, very negligible. You've got to basically vaccinate hundreds of, if not thousands of individuals to prevent one of them dying from COVID. Best case scenario, this is based on what we call non-randomized data, but let's just accept that as being true at the moment. But the absolute, the harms are going to, serious harms, seem to affect at least 1 in 800. It's probably much higher. So I think when people get that information, they're probably, you know, more likely to make an informed decision whether or not they want to take the vaccine. The reason I've called for the suspension is that we have suspended other vaccines for much, much less. And in particular, for me, the biggest concern is a cardiovascular effect with very good linking evidence in terms of it specifically causing quite serious heart problems, including heart attacks and sudden cardiac death. And that's why I think there's more of a reason that we need to stop it.
Thank you, Aseem. Now, I'm going to move on to censorship now, because I think this is really important. I mean, you are a dab hand at this. You're very articulate. You've got huge tenacity to fight and get your voice heard. But not all doctors have got that same set of skills as you have. And obviously, we've seen a lot of censorship of scientists and medical professionals being cancelled for social media. But also, you know, I think there's a lot of fear being placed on doctors about losing their license and having their career essentially stamped out. Can I just ask what your experience of this is, Aseem, and also what the impact you think this has on scientific debate going forward?
Well, first of all, I think to answer the second part first, James, the suppression of scientific discussion is the death of science. That's the first thing to say. I think people also need to understand that why this discussion is so important, and some people might be confused, because I think there's a myth out there that exists amongst many members of the public, and certainly amongst some doctors as well, is that medicine is an exact science, and nothing could be further from the truth. It's not an exact science like say, physics or chemistry. It's an applied science, it's a science of human beings, and it evolves. And one of the things we learn at medical school is 50% of what you learn at medical school will turn out to be either outdated or dead wrong within 5 years of your graduation. The trouble is nobody can tell you which half, so you have to learn on your own. I think you're absolutely right, it's not easy to do this sort of stuff. And I think if doctors are fearful of being censored or having their license, threatened, then it's understandable, of course, for them to stay silent. But my philosophy on this is that, you know, for me, if you can't speak up on behalf of your patient and about something you see that is harmful, then the title doctor loses its meaning. And, you know, what does that mean? It means that, one of the lines I use is that knowledge without action is vanity. Action without knowledge is insanity. But wisdom without courage is fruitless. So I have always adhered to those principles. That's something that the way I was brought up by my parents, my father in particular. The school that I went to instilled those values into me. So that's why I carry on doing what I'm doing. But we need more people just to speak up and speak out, because if we ultimately are, you know, if doctors are succumbing to guidelines that are heavily influenced, if not controlled by, you know, sociopathic entities that are there just to make money, then it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that when you are making clinical decisions that aren't in the interest of the patient, but more in interest of pharma, you're going to get either suboptimal outcomes for your patients or you're going to do harm. And it's one of the reasons that when I talk about this analysis of what's going on wrong with healthcare, is that's the root cause of the problem. You know, the real battle we've got now in healthcare is one of truth versus money. And part of overcoming this or moving this mountain does require people to have some courage and speak out. And I don't look at it from the virtuous perspective. I look at it from a rational perspective. You know, it's not safe to speak the truth. Of course, let's just establish that. Something Jordan Peterson articulates very well. It's not safe to speak the truth. You have to establish that. But it's even less safe to not speak, because the problem just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and becomes compounded. And then it becomes almost much more difficult, if not impossible, to overcome. So that's my approach to this.
Yeah, that's really profound, Aseem. I think, you know, and particularly striking, that if you know that a medical product that your profession is pushing out is doing harm, if you know that and you're a doctor and you do nothing, then you cease being a doctor. I think that's quite profound. And, you know, yeah, and I think the thing, you know, the message
well,
is,
James,
yeah.
Yeah. I think the thing to add in, sorry.
No, go
there,
for
I
it.
Think the other thing to put in, I think it's much harder for individuals to speak. I think as a group, if doctors, you know, if not enough doctors got together, then we're all protecting each other, because you can't revoke everybody's license. You know, if there was a bigger group of people, and that's happening, that has happened. And I've been very privileged to have a lot of support from some very eminent doctors around the world with my work. It becomes much harder to attack the individual, you know, and doctors are in a great position to help resolve this problem, because, you know, we are expert, we are trusted, we are committed, and we are the most powerful advocates for patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that doctors need to realize is, look, all of this information, I mean, there's overwhelming evidence now suggesting that there's a link with heart attacks, strokes, and lots of other symptoms as well, really serious symptoms. And the longer the doctors stay silent on this, they actually are doing immense damage to the medical profession, in my view. What's your opinion on that, Seem?
Yeah, James, I think the real issue is I only think there's a relatively smaller minority of doctors that are staying silent than the vast majority that are just simply not aware. You know, there is, and one of the reasons I would just, you know, just to give that personal experience on this, I was that person for some time where I could not accept the possibility that a vaccine could do any harm, especially not to the heart. So many doctors are still in that place. And one of the ways to get that information to them is, you know, I think that the people that are the most accountable, that I'm most disappointed with, are the medical authorities and the medical establishment, the regulators, people at the very top. They are turning a blind eye to this. They're not addressing it, you know, and many grassroots doctors look up and trust those medical leaders. And I think that the silence from them or the willful blindness from them is actually the real major root cause of the problem amongst why many doctors are not aware or are staying silent. Those are the people in this position of power. Those are the people we need to hold accountable for this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I totally buy into your willful blindness thing, but I think there are clearly people in government and in the regulators who know that these vaccines are doing damage. I mean, look at the AstraZeneca debacle last year. I mean, I think about five or six other regulators from different countries withdrew the AstraZeneca vaccine in the end of March. I think Denmark had vaccinated around 700,000 people by that point, and they'd picked up a serious safety signal. The MHRA at the time, we'd vaccinated millions in the UK, and they said they couldn't even find a signal. So the rollout carried on in the UK.
And we know now 9.7 million, James, with 800,000 yellow card reports on AstraZeneca. It was suspended, but we didn't know it was suspended. Right? And that's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
They withdrew it, but they effectively suspended it, but without publicizing it. It was sort of quietly removed. And for me, what I found out more recently, which totally shocked me, is the COVID shield vaccine, one of the vaccines that is used in India and still being used, was the AstraZeneca vaccine. And I went on on media channels in India to discuss this, and the doctors were not aware that we had effectively suspended it because of the safety concerns. And there are now, and there's lots of mixed data from India, but there is now data in India. People are contacting me. A lot of it's anecdotal evidence, but there are definite concerns that are being raised around heart attacks happening in younger and younger people in India. And if it's because of this AstraZeneca vaccine, and we could have told India a year and a half ago, I mean, yeah, I'll let other people draw their own conclusions from how bad that is.
Yeah, let's not start swearing on air, right? Okay, Asim, we've got another about 2-3 minutes. If you can give me a quick assessment, no longer than around 2 minutes, on where you think we are in terms of actually reaching the general public with this message.
Well, I think we are getting closer and closer. The needle has shifted. I think one of the biggest concerns I have is there's a clear disconnect with what the public think, and certainly growing members of the public are aware of in terms of their vaccine hesitancy, and what is being advised from the government and parts of the medical establishment. And that gap is getting bigger, and it's more and more disturbing. I think in terms of us getting to a point where there will be more dialogue and a positive action to really call for an investigation into these side effects that are very common and serious, I think we're getting closer. And I think that one of the reasons for that, you know, social media certainly has played a massive role, but it appears more and more of the mainstream are picking it up. I think some of the backlash in itself indirectly actually will only fuel the debate. I don't think it's going to cause any more suppression. I think there's an attempt by very powerful vested interests. That's part of the PR machinery of big corporations, is to something called opposition fragmentation. When the safety of their products are being threatened, they'll do everything they can to smear, attack doctors who are calling them out. So this is not new. But I think we have to not be complacent, James. We all have to keep speaking up. I can't do this alone. I've done this this is part of a team effort. I'm just building on the work of many other people that I've worked with and building on their evidence and their advocacy. So, but it needs more of us to speak out, because when we're getting closer.
Yeah. Very, very quickly, what would you suggest the general public can do apart from speaking on social media and telling people they know? What simple things can they do?
I think one very important, powerful thing is find out who your MP is. Write them a letter, share links of anything that they've seen. One of the things, again, is open access. You know, they can read my paper. It's in the Journal of Insulin Resistance, called Curing the Pandemic of Misinformation on the mRNA Vaccine Through Real Evidence-Based Medicine. They can read that. look at some interviews and then share it with their MP and ask their MP, what are you doing about it? What are you going to do about it?
Exactly. So if you're listening to this, find out who your MP is and write them a letter linking in all of the evidence that you're seeing from Dr. Aseem and other leading scientists and doctors around the world. Aseem, thank you so much for coming on the radio show with me. I'm honored that you would join me here today to bring your incredibly important message. So all I can say as a final note is carry on doing what you're doing, Aseem, because you're doing a fantastic job. Thank you very much. And
thank you,
this is James Wells.
It's a team effort.
Thank you, Aseem.